bulletins, which are actual cases without the names of officers involved, but it does give you a bit of a flavor for what the types of offenses or conduct and behavior these officers engage in that will result in or have resulted in the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training moving forward with a recommendation to deny or revoke certification of officers. Mr. Chairman, if I can, I'll move on to where I left off in the performance measure section, page 24. This is the section KPM number 5 and number 6, both dealing with private security. KPM number 5 deals with the private security industry, engages the overall professionalism of that industry.
I'm sorry, where are you, John?
Page 24.
Thank you.
And Mr. Harold Burke Sivers spoke on Tuesday before he left for Notre Dame and indicated that he felt that the reason that these targets seem to be upside down, you can see the target in 05 and 06 was 80 and 85%. Our actual numbers there were 47 and 48%, pretty dismal. Our 2007 target is 85, meaning that less than half of the constituency, the professionalism of the private security industry at better than average. And there seems to be some potential inverting of the rating scale, and the staff are reviewing that as to whether or not it's actually working the way it's supposed to. But Mr. Burke Sivers indicated that he felt that, although this is anecdotal, that there are a number of individuals working within the professional private security industry who are complying and are on that professional track, but there are a bulk of other individuals who are not. And so there's still within that profession remains a disparity between those who are moving towards a more professional process within that industry and others who choose not to or are somewhat recalcitrant. KPM number 6, overall professionalism of private security officers. We have a similar result, although the officers are rating themselves, and the targets were 80 in 2005. The actual result was 68, 85 in 2006, and the actual result was 77. So it is moving up a little bit, and again, there are no comparable benchmarks that we're aware of to gauge where we are. KPM number 7 on page 25, providing accessible and accurate records for all DPSST constituents. Targets in 2005, 90%. The actual result was 83. 2006 was 90%, again 83. And again, our target remains in 2007, 90%. The comment here is that staff shortages have resulted in backlogs, which have a negative impact on this area. And this is one of the areas of the agency, for those members who may have been around for a number of years, I believe it was in the 01 or I believe the 03 session, this section of the agency took some fairly substantial reductions in staffing, and they're generally lower-level positions, but they're data entry and individuals that need to process paperwork, so they did suffer fairly substantial backlogs, and they're working pretty diligently to try to improve that. But in addition, the board, Chairman.
Representative Pennant. I didn't mean to cut your thought.
But all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had this discussion in the last session about this particular performance measure, and accessible and accurate in one measurement and then having that target, and then to say that staffing shortages have resulted in backlogs. The backlogs, I think, would have an impact on the staff shortages in terms of the accessibility side of it, but it doesn't, it likely wouldn't measure against the accuracy. And that, we kicked this around a little bit before, and I just want to bring it up again. It just doesn't resonate with me that those two should be in one measurement, because it's one thing to say we have the records and we're not getting to them quick enough. It's another thing to say that the records are accurate.
Mr. Chairman, I'll throw my hands up and say I think you're probably technically right. You could probably split the two. I think one of the reasons that you'll have a problem with accuracy is that oftentimes the maintenance training or field training, the things that go on out in the region, are signed up for and verified on a form that's different than the forms, or not different, but in a different venue than the ones we use internally. So those have to then be manually lined up. Oftentimes we'll have two records for the same training program, so they have to be audited individually. And that's why when an agency pulls up their record, they look at it and say, well, I went to this training, it's not here. Well, that's because the person who had filled out the F6 form didn't forward it to the agency. So then we'll have to do a follow-up and call the agency or the trainer and say, where's the F6 form? And they'll send it to us, and then it's reconciled. That's where the automation issue will help. And there's some discussion last session also about having uploaded records from agencies. It's yet to be accomplished, but it's still kind of hopefully in the queue at some point. Mr. Chairman, if I can. back to the with respect to this accessibility of records too. I wanted to mention that the board did institute a maintenance training standard that became effective in December of this last year, which is the first reporting period for maintenance training. There was a huge volume of information coming in from agencies that created an even larger backlog, but they're chipping away at it as much as they can, and we've tried to do some borrowing of staff internally and loaning them to from different sections to try to make up this backlog and try to cut it down as best we can. KPM number 8, I believe, is a KPM that was added during this last legislative session, dealing with the percentage of customer rating satisfaction with DPSSD services at average or excellent. Target was 85%, and the actual was 77%. Our target, again, remains for 2007 at 85%. And we do believe that, frankly, even though we're not quite meeting that target yet, we think some of our internal strategies and external strategies are beginning to work. If I could flip over to page 26... managing for results, dealing with quality assurance, quality improvement. These are just some of the ways that we gather information both internally and externally. Under the Academy-based programs, we have the Academy Training Operations Management System, or ATOMS, which is a methodology that eventually will help us gather more information. And we have the first phase of that implemented or being implemented as we speak. We have the Standards and Training Ad Hoc Reporting System. We call it STARS. This is a system that is it's a student system, but basically the students will get, at the end of the day, go to one of the computers, pull up the STARS system, and rate the instructors for the various classes for that day. And that information is available on a daily basis to review. It actually helps us quite a bit because we now know whether an instructor's walked into a classroom, and which has happened before, unfortunately, and said, forget everything, it's on the PowerPoint, I'm going to teach you how to do the following things in law enforcement. We definitely frown on that. We do want them to stick to the PowerPoints and stay to the performance objectives. Field training officer surveys are surveys that come back with respect to the performance of the officers who they're supervising and going through the field training manuals. That tells us how the officers that are being sent out are doing, and it also tells us to the extent to which field training officers understand what the curriculum is. And I think I alluded to this once before, that oftentimes people who've gone through the training program like I did in 1977 have a different perspective of what the training's like than what it is in the current environment. We have comment cards on meal services at the Academy, which are posted in public view so people can read them if they don't like the food or the food's not served hot or if the kitchen's dirty and these kind of things. And our vendor, Aramark, tries to respond to those things in a timely fashion. The field training officer involvement in calls for service week, which is proposed for the 16th week of the basic training program. I think I talked about that a little bit. We're trying to entice the officers that are going to actually be supervising the trainees to come to the Academy or another individual who can from the agency from which the officer has been hired to participate in the calls for a week to help supervise and participate in the oversight of that 16th week of training. That will hopefully give us additional information about how they feel the training is going and how well the students are adapting. And then we personally go and visit, both Eric's and I and the command staff from the training division go and visit with the middle management class and have a discussion feedback about how they're viewing the progression of the organization. And it's interesting and informative because many of the individuals coming to the mid-management class have not been to the Academy for many years since their basic training program, so they're surprised to see that we're moving as progressively in many of the directions that we're going. Strategic planning process, I believe I mentioned before, the board has undertaken a strategic planning process back in December of 2005. Portland State University is facilitating that through the Hatfield School, and they're just at the point where they're winding up the board version of that, and they'll be now transitioning over to the internal agency implementation, hopefully looking at targets and some developing some plans for results, some action plans within the agency to achieve what the board expects us to achieve. The DPSSD listening tours, again, one methodology for us going out and actually asking our constituents how we're doing, and we get both positive and negative feedback, and we also are able to clear up some of the misconceptions about how we function or operate, and in some cases to simply tell people that their expectations, frankly, are not realistic. That happens from time to time, unfortunately. Validation of standards and certification training through job task analysis survey instruments. So these job task analysis surveys are accomplished, I believe, on an incremental 5-year basis. Mm-hmm. We're currently finished a police job task analysis recently. We're doing parole and probation and corrections job task analyses. And those are also connected to the physical agilities and medical review panels connected with the performance of those individual professions. External reviews by experts. The State Office, State Acts Insurance Fund was recently out looking at our training methodologies and how we're dealing with safety issues on site, and the results were relatively good. They felt like we seemed to be paying particular attention to safety in both in the venues, and it's very important when you're dealing with defense tactics and driving and you know, various kinds of activities that could result in somebody's injury or death. They seem to be very impressed. Or OSHA recently also did a visit. In addition, the agency has participated with, in a cooperative way, with the Sexual Assault Task Force, the Department of Justice. The Sexual Assault Task Force, as an entity, is going to be coming in and teaching the sexual assault classes within the agency, basic training curriculum, which is a major step for them, and frankly, we're excited to have them on site because it alleviates us from having to have a whole cadre of other individuals to instruct that program, and they have a very good curriculum that's been developed and has been reviewed by the agency. With respect to racial profiling, the agency's participated with the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee and the folks from that group to actually create scenarios that are oriented towards dealing with racial minorities and some of the perceptions that officers may have when they make traffic stops. And there's a $300,000 grant. I believe Mr. Prinz is here, and he may or may not speak directly to that, that's been awarded to the LECC from the federal government for the purpose of dealing with these issues. Our agency's participating in partnership with the Criminal Justice Commission and Portland State University to hopefully advance their work. Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I can, I'll move to funding sources for the agency. The vast majority of the funding comes from the criminal fines and assessment account. That includes basic police, basic corrections, basic parole and probation, criminal justice leadership. A regional is both mostly criminal fines and assessment account money. There's a small amount of traffic enforcement, SFST or field sobriety training that comes through an ODOT grant, Oregon Department of Transportation grant. Standard certification is primarily funded from the CFAA stream, and then the administration primarily through CFAA. You go back up to basic telecommunications, emergency medical dispatch is funded through the 911 telephone tax, which is up for reauthorization this session. Fire is funded through the fire insurance premium tax. Private security or fee-based programs funded through their own fees to members of both private investigative fields and private security. And then administration is also funded to some degree with chargebacks to the various other programs that have other revenue forces or streams. There's a pie chart showing the 2007-2009 governor's recommended budget by total revenue source, $52,170,008. And then it's broken down with the various revenue streams for your convenience. And I'd love if you want me to go through those numbers, it might be.
I think the general would be fine.
Okay. When the state police now shifted into you, did they transfer any money with that, or is that just?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, no, they did not send any money. The only money we received from the Oregon State Police would be from our lease agreement for their rental of the space, but they're absorbed into the CFAA training stream.
Mr. Chair, there was a reduction made in the state police budget last biennium with anticipation of them moving over to here.
Thanks. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
John, on my general fund pie chart, the percentage didn't copy well.
General fund is $11,342,003.
Right, and that percent, it's going to be about 18-19% or so.
Look at my technical expertise back here. Mine isn't copied well either, I'm sorry. That, by the way, general fund is all debt service on the COPs. I'm sorry, the 21.74.
21.7?
Yes, sir.
And that's good. Great. Follow-up. That's good follow-up for information flow. That's debt service on the
That's
on
correct. The only general fund we receive is for debt service.
Okay.
Turning to page 30, basic training expense distribution. This is here to just explain who pays for what. Generally, there have been some discussions about this. DPSST provides the training and instruction, meals and lodging, ammunition, targets, and classroom materials. The employing agencies, because these individuals have to be hired by an organization before they're entering into the basic training programs, provide the students' salaries, the students' personal equipment, safety equipment, their handguns, and other agency-loaned instructors that come in and work without compensation, although they may be reimbursed for travel expenses if they're not paid a particular salary. And then depending on the length of employment of these... Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again.
All right.
Mr. Menace, there was somebody, I don't know if you're in here, there was a commissioner from Lincoln County who said we shouldn't pay, they didn't want to pay officer salaries. Wouldn't that be pretty disruptive? And he was concerned about them being hired away, and it would seem to me that it would be better for the cities to come up with their own compact and agreement not to hire away, but I don't know how we'd expect to hire a lot of police that would have to starve for 4 months.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, without getting into it too deeply, there have been a lot of different machinations trying to reduce costs at the local level for salaries. It is a problem for small agencies and in some cases large agencies alike, where they've invested a large amount of money in training and salaries for an officer, and then they're enticed away. There's disparity among salaries, and I think the individual testified that he didn't believe it was because of salary, but in his particular jurisdiction. But I do believe it plays a bit of a role. I do think you've hit on an interesting point, and that is most of the officers come in, they're not 21 years old. 21 years old is pretty young. I mean, that's the age at which you can become a police officer, but it's probably rare to see a 21-year-old. There's a few of them floating around, but most of them are 25 to 35 years old going through the academy. Most are married, have family and children. So, I mean, unless somebody has an independent source of income, I think it would be highly unlikely that they would be able to continue their training. And there is a difference. And with that, again, getting into it too deeply, I've had conversations with California Post. California has is a different sort of police officer training funding mechanism. They are more like our standards and certification section on steroids. They don't run any police academies. They leave it up to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, Los Angeles Police Department, and others to run their own police academies, and they set standards, and then they do inspections and audits, and they fund these academies and are basically a money spigot. You can become get a police officer certification in California by going to a community college, and this issue has been discussed here in Oregon. But the difficulty is, even in California, if you graduate from a police academy in a community college, the likelihood, once you're hired by an agency, of immediately going to work and having comparability between that community college training program and the basic program in any agency is highly unlikely. More likely you'll end up as a security guard, or you're going to be recycled back through the LA County Sheriff's Department basic training program or this kind of thing. So I although I have empathy, because this does happen throughout Oregon, some agencies have in fact entered into employment contracts with employees when they hire them, and then if the employee breaches that contract, have filed litigation suits against that individual for repayment. Several months ago, the International Association of Chiefs of Police magazine had a discussion with Los Angeles Police Department was suing another agency, I think Santa Cruz or one of these agents, because they'd enticed away a person who had just graduated from the academy. So, again, it's not just an Oregon problem. It seems to be happening on a national basis, and if you tie that back to the number of individuals not going into law enforcement and criminal justice careers, it's a very competitive market out there. It's very competitive.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll move on to policy option packages, and hopefully this will bring our presentation to a close, at least for the time being. Policy packages, this is on page 32. We've also tied our KPMs to the policy packages at the request of the co-chair. I will admit that this may be a stretch in some instance, because this is kind of an unusual, attempt to try to look at the existing KPMs and then tie them to the packages per se in a more very specific way, so that may be a little bit more tangential. But policy package 115 is the full implementation of the 16-week basic training course. It includes 16 additional positions, 2 basic police coordinators, 4 public safety training specialists, 1 for role players. Now, I should just mention briefly, there are two classifications, PSTS-1 and PSTS-2. PSTS-1 is generally a position allocated in FTE that is broken up in hours as we bring in part-time instructors. So if you look at it as a position, that isn't a single body. That is a multiplicity of people that we're going to hire and use those hours for them to deliver training. Although we do have, on occasion, a PSTS-1 position that's been converted to full-time, the bulk of the PSTS-1 positions are used for our part-time instructor pool, which is about 350 part-time instructors right now. They will also be used for evaluators, and we have PSTS-1s for remediation and instructor maintenance purposes. One of the things that we have as a difficulty within our training program is an individual may go through a skills venue, emergency vehicle operations, firearm, or defense tactics, and they have not actually passed that portion of the course because their performance has not measured up. The difficulty is remediating that particular deficiency in the academy while the officer is currently in the academy. What we're hoping to do is to be able to mitigate some of those deficiencies in the academy, but more often than not, these folks are going to have to come back to the academy to remediate their various performances. And in most instances, it's not an academic failure. It has to do with the skills training portion of the training. Currently, we have no specific staff dedicated or set aside to do remediation, so it does eat into our basic core mission to do that.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes, sir.
On the idea of remediation, Portland Police has a very large bureau, as you know, and people make mistakes, and rather than, you know, kicking them off the force, or it might seem appropriate to allow people to go back to DPSST and get some more training if they made a mistake in a particular instance. Does that type of thing happen on a day-to-day basis?
Mr. Chairman, yes. More often than not, the individuals will come back. They'll remediate and remediate successfully. I think it's infrequent that someone's actually graduated from the academy and they've not subsequently passed that particular skill. But there are individuals who from time to time just don't do well with firearms, or they don't do well with the EVOC, Emergency Vehicle Operations Training Program. We try to make the call internally and in discussions with the agencies that employ these individuals if we think that the likelihood of their failure is high and we don't think that ultimately they're going to master the skill. In many instances, once those conversations occur, the agency will terminate the employment and pull the individual out of the academy. But in most instances, it's a fairly extreme case of individuals who are just not getting it.
And what about on use of force decisions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
If use of force decision that a police officer makes, if it's determined that they made a mistake or they shouldn't have used the degree of force in this particular situation, do they ever go back to you for remediation on those kinds of?
Post-graduation and actual certification, no. Although I think most of the individuals within the public safety field would love the opportunity to come back and have additional training in the various perishable skills areas. But where you have a specific officer who perhaps hasn't measured up internally and the agency finds a deficiency in their action, we don't have a remedial course specific to that, if that was the question.
Yeah, my last question is, do you think that would be useful in your experience as a police officer or not so much?
Mr. Chairman, my response just off the top of my head would be, as long as we're having that conversation with the agency and specifically and working in concert with them, then I think there could be some profitability in having a program or class to remediate use of force situations. The difficulty, of course, is that they're so high profile and there are, you know, huge liability issues that arise from somebody not performing well, that again, it would have to be a partnership, I think, with the agencies and our department to try to develop something that folks would buy into and feel comfortable with. Again, that kind of an extension of our regional training program and the use of Range 3000 and EVOC training programs is to try to do this anyway, to try to continue this kind of training to mitigate, and not just to mitigate a problem with a specific employee, but rather to make sure that the competency and skills are at a high level for all officers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Going back to, we have a request for two PSTS-2 Rangemasters. The difference here is PSTS-2s are generally full-time employees of the agency and are subject matter experts in their particular skill. One of the things I do want to mention that these individuals are not usually someone you can hire off the street and then train up as a brand spanking new employee and improve their skills from the ground up internally. So we, by virtue of who we need for employees, have to go out and proselytize. We have to go try
entice them away.
We're part of the problem, in fact, when you talk about, you know, when you see a good employee and somebody who is a subject matter expert who is highly desirable, we want to go after those people because we want them to come in and teach for us. We do have some difficulties from time to time with the competitiveness of our salaries compared to the metropolitan area and where individuals within the larger metropolitan police departments where experience levels tend to be high and the level of training tends to be higher, our salaries are not generally comparable with most of those entities. So if they do come to work for us, it's not to say that they won't. They're coming to work for us because it's more of an altruistic purpose. They want to teach, they want to train, and that does happen from time to time. What we do find, and this has happened before, where we have somebody on the hook and we think we've got them, you know, they go home and talk to their wife and say, I'm going to go home and take $1,000 a month cut in pay, and that usually stops it right there. So PSTS-2 instructors, training development coordinators to continue the kind of development of training that we've been talking about in the regional training programs, and then also in the area of instructor development courses to increase the competency of our current instructors. The health and fitness instruction area, we've requested two health and fitness instructors, two tactical and PIT instructors. PIT is pursuit intervention technique training. This is a tactical maneuver that is generally designed to shorten or stop a high-speed pursuit. This is generally something that's advised to occur at less than 35 miles an hour. It's a very successful and very effective technique, but I wouldn't suggest trying it on your own without some training because the likelihood of killing someone is relatively high if you're up above 35 miles an hour if you don't do it in the right place. So it does require a lot of training. Our agency currently just does a familiarization with the pursuit intervention technique, and the request is to have tactical trainers to carry out this PIT training for all agencies throughout the state. We also have a series of pieces of equipment that we're requesting, a push-pull machine, which some of you may have seen in the gymnasium that's related to the Oregon Physical Agilities testing program, and that's to increase our ability to take that out regionally and to further our advancement of the physical fitness nutrition concepts within the regional training program, refurbishing a skid car frame for emergency vehicle operations, to keep a sufficient number of machines available for our use both internally at the academy and regionally, because we do hold some regional emergency vehicle operations training programs. The radar LIDAR units, which we need more of for the purpose of training, steel targets for ammunition at the range. Steel targets, if you are out on the range, I'm not sure if most everyone was here, but when you went out onto the range, I think I mentioned that it's designed so that you could drive a car on or you could set up various kind of tactical maneuvers and shooting and moving types of situations. In fact, when I went through and did my firearms training here just recently to qualify, they had me running up and down the hallway till they got my heart rate, the entire class. I was with a corrections class. So then we had to run back in, and then we're in a running shooting situation to see whether or not we could accurately shoot while our blood pressure was up and our heart was beating pretty fast. I found that I'm not as young as I used to be. I might think I am, but my body doesn't respond appropriately. But it's good training because it does show you that you're not functioning well under pressure necessarily when you're breathing real hard and can't see straight. Ballistic wall sections for firearms range. Again, these are materials that are designed to help build the various scenarios within the range. And then stinger spike strips or stop sticks. These are, you might, again, pursuit intervention types of techniques to stop a particular pursuit. There is no training in this area currently, and the agency would like to move into that venue. Mr. Chairman, Policy Package 118, the reclassification of the job task analysis coordinator, reclass of the classroom specialist, and let me see. They're kind of jumping along because the Policy Package 18 reclasses relate to the individuals who work within the Police Policy Package 115. There are a number of reclasses within the agency, which is where DAS, the Department of Administrative Service Budget and Management, have reviewed the functions and various work of these individuals and has authorized the reclassification.
Minnesota, so maybe this would be a good opportunity for us people who are new to
sure.
Ways and Means to give us a Ways and Means 101 on what reclass actually means.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do have, fortunately, my expert consultant next to me, so I will try my very best. All of the positions within the state classification system have position descriptions associated with it, including my own. And within that job description, there is an analysis that is done to try to determine what this appropriate salary and salary benefits are pretty much constant throughout the state system, but what that salary rate should be. So each time the responsibilities or the job function change, and sometimes it changes by virtue of the agency wants to go a different direction, so they want to reclass this person so that they can begin to maybe recruit somebody in a higher level, their skills are higher, and they can do more work. Or by virtue of the agency's direction and movement, this person is already doing the work. And any employee within the Ask Me bargaining unit, our employees can ask for what's called a desk audit. The employee thinks, well, I think I'm doing a lot more than what my job description really says I'm supposed to be doing, and it's much more than the 5% of other duties as assigned. They can ask for a desk audit. Our human resources section will go in, and they're trained experts in the same classification system that DAS uses, and they will do an analysis, and if in fact they believe that those responsibilities have increased or decreased, they'll recommend a classification up or a classification down. And in many instances, when we go through budget, those reclasses are generally have to go through budget management and be blessed, if you will, by budget management to verify that that in fact the agency's analysis is consistent with the analysis of the budget management. And I can go back to about 1987 when the state passed the Hay evaluation methodology system. I do believe I voted against it back then for some odd reason. I remember the debate. But the state uses the Hay classification system, which is a methodology far beyond me, that theoretically applies to all of the various functions within job classifications. And I don't know if you want to ask the expert. That was my ramble.
That was well done. Linda, would you like to add anything? Could you take the microphone and identify yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. I will add for the record that we are budget analysts. We are not human resource analysts. And so when these requests come through either administratively during the biennium or in the budget process, we make sure that we run them through our HR department to make sure that all the I's have been dotted, the T's have been crossed, and this is a correct classification change.
Mr. Chair, I think it should be noted that Linda did mention administratively or legislatively, I believe. Agencies have the ability to go through the process of reclasses without the legislative participation if they can, what is called internally, finance them, which means that if the cost of a position goes up, they have to find an equal downward position reclassification in another position, so it balances out over time. And you can have very large reclass packages in large agencies that to achieve this. The legislature gets involved when an agency is unable to or would rather not internally finance the permanent financing of them, and they will bring them forward. In this case, they are asking for the reclasses here plus additional limitation to fund these reclasses. So in this case, there are no downward motion in the in other positions. And for the lack of me, I can't remember how much in this position you're asking for.
Mr. Chairman, Doug, I don't believe that we were given any authority in the governor's recommended budget to ask for additional money. These are assumed to be financed internally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, can I get a clarifying answer potentially? But you mentioned that in reclassifications, the agency has to have a corresponding reduction in another position. But I thought that's what I heard you say.
Mr. Chair, when they're trying to do it without legislative participation, when the legislature participates, the legislature can grant the additional limitation if they so wish.
But would it hold true that if the agency had a reduction of FTE
and then included a reclassification as long as the dollar amount didn't exceed the former FTE level in payroll, not in benefit, but in pay, that still applies. We've seen that budget, and I've seen that happening this session, and I'm under the impression that's the way that would work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hinn, I'm not sure if I'm completely following you, but in some agencies will reduce FTE to find the internal permanent financing. That's
exactly where I'm going. Yeah.
Because they have internally judged that it's more important to increase the classification of employee X than to retain employee Y at the same level.
Thank you.
And then, Senator Wesson.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Doug, but I think Director Minnis used a very good word, arcane system. I mean, this plugs into our PICS, personnel employee classification system. You know, reclasses in, say, DPSST, you know, have implications system-wide. And in this case, DPSST will have numerous positions that fill equal functions all throughout state government. I mean, administrative assistants, staff, IT, I mean, there's a lot of similar work that they do that is, you know, done in DHS and DOC and DAS. So it's a very interconnected, almost, you know, it's a Byzantine thing to look at. But it, at the end of the day, we've got a pretty good handle on what we're paying position X at DPSST, DHS, and DAS. But, I mean, to look at this thing, John says arcane, I say Byzantine.
And just so that I understand, Mr. Minnis, what I hear you saying is you didn't have to come bring this reclass to us to ask for more money, but you felt it was a significant move in your budget and you wanted to let us know?
Mr. Chairman, actually, the governor didn't authorize the additional funds for it, and the direction was to finance it internally. Hence, we support the governor's budget and we're not asking for additional resources.
Gotcha.
Mr. Chair, before he moves on, it is much more Byzantine or archaic or complex than we sort of talked about, because there is the financial actual dollar part of reclasses, and there's something called permanent financing, and I would rather do this with someone people else individually if you really want to learn about it, but it is, that's what makes it, as Senator Westland talked about, so complex and interactive.
Right. Mr. Do that in another day, maybe in the interim.
Chair, if I can add, just when I came into the agency as the director, I abolished several positions and then established several positions that were reclasses or classifications added with the approval of Human Resources and Department of Administrative Services. So I had to come up with a finance plan that showed where am I going to come up with the money. So I had to abolish a position or show that I had excess authority. And there is a finance plan that has to be submitted to just document that. So it can be a zero-sum game. Sometimes it gets a little bit stressful to make that work within the cash flow. But, as I said, we support the governor's budget. Now, Mr. Chairman, if I can, policy package 119, Academy Maintenance is adding, requesting to add 7 positions, Ground Maintenance Worker 1, a Physical Electronic Security Technician 2, and the student workers for various trades and inmate labor. We don't have currently any funding specific to, other than the construction budget, I believe, inmate labor. We are wanting to continue to use inmates from the various institutions to help us with the groundskeeping, and we find it, quite frankly, find it to be a very effective and cost-efficient pool of labor. Student workers, Mr. Chairman, sorry.
Thank you, Director Minnis. On the grounds maintenance piece, you've subbed out food service and other things. Why not grounds maintenance?
Well, Mr. Chairman, good question, Representative. We haven't taken bids for it because the concept, as the budget was submitted in the last biennium, was to build a staff with it being augmented by either student labor or inmate labor. We didn't add inmate labor last session because we weren't that far along. We didn't know what it would take or what we'd be requesting. I suppose one can take bids for that kind of thing, but I find that there's actually a benefit in having our own staff because, quite frankly, well, let me give you an example. I looked out my window one day, and we have one particular individual who's one of our grounds maintenance workers. He's standing with five inmates from the Oregon State Penitentiary and their supervisor. He's the only guy that's working. In fact, I looked out the window and I said, Eric, come look at this. And here's our guy, and he's working like a madman, planting trees and doing all this. And here's all the inmates standing around watching the guy along with his supervisor. The effect for me, if they're my employees, is if there's a disciplinary problem or performance problem, I can deal with it. With a contractor, I have to go through the contractor. And let me give you an example. If we have Aramark, as we do currently doing food service or garden services, which is a required service that we're first required to go to, if I have a performance problem with one of those organizations, let's use Aramark, and I have to terminate the contract, it creates a huge, huge problem for my organization to backfill and provide meals for all the students coming through my agency. So I think it works where you have large contractors who are proven and tested. And you may be right, Mr. Representative. It may very well work. We have not gone down that road or explored it, and it was not the direction that we were given.
Just as a follow-up, I mean,
are you trying to find work for Representative Kitt?
Why is everybody laughing?
That was true.
Well, I just as we review these type of items, I mean, I know that you do contract the food service. It seems as though there are lots of reputable large contractors that do that type of work, and it seemed like the place that it might be. I guess it's not. It doesn't go without saying you couldn't at some point. Or
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, for the record, Eric Gablick, Deputy Director, DPSST. I think the question you raise is a good one if we truly looked at it only as a grounds maintenance worker. So if we were looking at just someone to take care of the grass and to do the trimmings and those kind of things, I think your question has a lot of merit. The one challenge that we have at the facility, and those of you who came out and saw the facility, realize it's more than just a training facility. It's a venue that has a number of moving parts. So the grounds maintenance workers not only take care of the outdoor grass and the trees and those things, but they also install benches and they repair those benches. They also set up the auditorium for graduation. So it's a lot of things that we couldn't have a contract crew, for example, there every day to do those kind of things, which then, in essence, would almost become a hydraulic situation where now somebody else has to come in and do that part. So I think if we truly look at it just as that one landscape issue, I think you're right, but really these positions do a lot of other things in interim besides just outdoor care.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize this is a new facility, new campus. Takes a little while to figure out how things are going to work on the long term. But I'm kind of curious about two or three things. One is I'd like you to explain in just a sentence or two the point on student worker trades. I'm also wondering, seven positions for academy maintenance sounds like a lot. How many positions are described for academy maintenance at the present time? And when this facility was being planned and budgeted by previous legislatures, were the projections pretty off target, or was there no anticipation for this kind of maintenance? How did we end up with so quickly needing to see a policy package to add seven more?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathanson, very good question. The answer is, as we were developing the budget in the 2005 legislative session, or for the 2005 legislative session, we didn't have very many comparables that would tell us how to staff up for this particular function. And an example of that, we hired away the maintenance facilities manager from Western Oregon University. They have about 550,000 square feet of space on campus there. We have 338,000 square feet. So to some degree, we brought this person on early. We were relying on some of his views and opinions about what it would take to run the campus. And he, at that time when he came on, felt that we were understaffed, in his opinion. So let me go back, and you've got the numbers for the current. Our current facility staff, we have 12 positions, 7.61 FTE. And as I mentioned earlier, that includes a an electrician, a plumber, and a carpenter who are licensed professionals in their trade. The other individuals are grounds maintenance workers of various classifications, so generalists. This is not my field of expertise, running buildings. All I can tell you is when I hired my facilities manager, he said, John, there's one thing you need to know about me. Anything I touch costs money. He said, and the buildings are brand new, but they will rot right out from under you. And, it's a very expensive proposition to maintain the building. So far, his prophecy, if you will, is proving true, because things do break. And as we're closing the contract out, we're finding some interesting discussions between Hoffman and the various contractors about what's our responsibility and what's warranty and what's not. So I can tell you that we were doing our best guess with the best information we had at the time. And quite frankly, we built pretty much a community college out here without a lot of reference in doing it, probably on the cheap if we were looking at community college structures and how they're dealing with part-time instructors and how they're dealing with maintenance and staff. So I think our dependence was going back to the student workers. We have Corbin College just down the street from us. We have Western Oregon University, or not Western Oregon, excuse me, we have Willamette University. Our thought was to have students who can use a job to feed them into our system. If we can pay them a small stipend to come in and paint or to do pickup type projects and being supervised by a tradesperson, that will help facilitate our ability to get our work done. That's what Western Oregon University does, and we've stolen that model because we stole their maintenance manager. And then the use of the inmate labor, again, is very, very inexpensive, although we do have to have certain people who are trained up to supervise. We have several of our staff who have been trained by the Department of Corrections to supervise inmates. All I can tell you is this is 213 acres of wetlands and a lot of grass and a lot of plants and trees and shrubs and a lot of buildings that, quite frankly, when a toilet backs up and, everything starts leaking, they could call me, but I couldn't tell them how to fix it. We could call Roto-Rooter, but I'm not sure if the response time would be very, very good. But we're willing to try pretty much anything that the legislature tells us to do. So.
Well, in relation to what the good representative from Roseburg said, you should not interpret our quietness on the question of contracting out as unanimous support for that notion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think they're good. They're puts and takes on both sides, quite frankly. And I probably would have sided with the contracting out before, but I think being in the position I'm at now, I think having some control over the work product and the effectiveness of their endeavors, I think helps me, and I tend to side with that. But there are places where the contracting out does work very well. The other thing in the academy.
I think that's a good thing to use some of the prisoners and the voters and all the legislators, told the Department of Corrections to have the people work. And I think that's a meaningful job. The only caveat I'd say, so we don't have to repeat history, years ago there was some sheriff's deputies training on how to disarm somebody that had a gun on you. And so the prisoners were watching that. Watching the training, and had several months of nothing to do but practice disarming. An Oregon State policeman ended up without a gun and handcuffed to a tree one time. So these people, while it's great to have them doing that, I would really ask you to keep them away from the instructions so they not able to take that back to the prison. And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, you're absolutely right. In fact, when the scenario-based training is going on, that's one of the reasons that there was a fence built and it's a secure perimeter. Even the maintenance people whose office is down inside that scenario area will be restricted in terms of their movements in and out during the scenario-based training. We simply do not want to get somebody killed, and we definitely do not want to train inmates to do something that they shouldn't be doing. The other thing is there's a berm that's been built around the jail that's there to try to prevent, line of sight observation.
You're ahead of me. Thank you.
Thank you. I did want to mention also there's a request for a computerized maintenance management system, which is basically the software necessary to do the various requests for service and tracking those requests and the successful completion of those request in policy package 120. The support services increase is increasing the background investigator position from 17 months to 24 months. The agency, when I became the director of the agency, one of the things we did is some fairly comprehensive and in-depth research on the agency. Who are we? What do we do? Why do we do it? What's our authority under the statute? And we've instituted comprehensive background investigations on all of our employees. I would dare say we probably do the most comprehensive background investigations of any state agency. And And we do that simply because we believe that the background investigations will preclude further problems down the road. And we think that the level of professionalism amongst our own employees since instituting that has increased fairly dramatically. So we want to increase that so we can continue to do comprehensive background. And we're applying those to part-time instructors coming in, too, even if they're coming from another agency, because the agency does have authority to request the background investigation accomplished by a police agency and then supplement that or augment that with a CCH or law enforcement data systems check and driver's license check, credit history, just to make sure that we're not dealing with somebody who's found themselves in trouble after they were employed by a police agency. And then adding information system specialist fourth, the information services division to support campus functions. When you were touring the site, you may have noticed that there's a lot of infrastructure with respect to information systems, including security cameras, wireless access. Our agency, unless this has changed recently, is the only state agency other than the data center that has voice over internet protocol phones. So we have, frankly, a lot of technology on site, and our hope is to maximize the use of that technology. Flipping over to page 34, policy package regional training. Policy package 124 is tied to KPM number 2, providing training to Oregon Liquor Control Commission agents at on a cost recovery basis. We already do this. What we found we were doing is we're eating our seed corn. We had authorization for so many positions in the PSTS 1 category for part-time instructors. We were providing a training which we were being financially reimbursed for, but we were reducing by using those hours on a purpose other than their core function. So as opposed to the basic training program, they were spending their time on Oregon Liquor Control Commission agent training. What we're trying to do is have an increase so that we can accommodate this particular program and not eat into our seed corn with PSTS 1 training positions. Policy package, if I can, number 121, fire service training, requests an additional 3 training staff for the fire training coordinator at the academy. The Code 3 driving program, 2 instructors that were mentioned at a previous discussion for regional driving for these large rigs. Acquisition of a skid truck for the Code 3 program, which is germane to specific equipment that they use in fire service. The equipment for the tactical tower training, again, this is various kinds of props and smoke devices for smoking the hallways and this kind of thing. Equipment for the fire apparatus of the academy. We had a donation of a $200,000 pumper truck from Freightliner Corporation. It didn't come with hoses and, you know, the various items that need to be attached to it, so this is to add that equipment to the truck. And then the deployment of a 53-foot mobile fire training unit around the regions for, again, as a fire training prop. Moving to page 36, policy package 117, 2 positions. This is in the standards of certification or revocation denial actions of that section. 2 positions, a compliance specialist and a public service representative. One of the things that we didn't mention about standards certification, they're also responsible for the front desk and reception area when you walk into the academy. So not only are they doing records and records maintenance, they're also maintaining a flow of individuals coming in and out of the facility through that front desk. Policy package 118, position reclasses, we talked about before, training records specialist from a 1 to a 2, records maintenance specialist from a specialist 2 to administrative support specialist. I can't get the word out. 1. And then in private security investigators, there are no policy option packages that have been requested. Then back to policy package 117, accuracy and availability of records, under KPM number 7. Again, standards and certification section, policy package 117, 2 positions, compliance specialist 2, public service representative. Did I just read that?
That's a repeat. Because they both support that KPM.
I see. Okay, great. So why am I reading this? Okay. Let's skip down to page 39, policy option package, customer service, number 117, 2 positions, again, same thing, compliance specialist. These are the same patient positions being repeated. And then policy package 118, position reclasses for training record specialist, the director's office, executive support specialist 1 to a 2, and executive support specialist 2 to an executive assistant, and so on and so forth down the list. With that, I have my notes to shut up, be quiet, and smile. And answer any questions, of course.
I've got one. If anybody else for any questions, Mr. Minnis, on the mental health and cultural competency thing. Sometime before we go to work session, maybe you can come back by my office and maybe we can put our heads together to see if there's ways that we can turn the mental health training into the KPM, the cultural competency into a KPM, if that's even possible, or if you think it might be possible to also take a look at if there's any type of outcomes we can measure on deadly use of force. I would think that if you're training people well, the decision-making in that realm would be better over time.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. We'll take a look at that, and we'll have some internal discussions, and I'll set up an appointment with your office to try to come back and talk to you a little bit more about that. And I think if you look at the one handout on mental health training, I believe we're going from 4 hours to 12 hours of classroom. It doesn't get us to that crisis intervention training level, the 40-hour Tennessee model.
And to follow up on that, you know, they're doing a certain number of hours there. Is there... maybe that could simply be one of the KPMs that they've completed this. But I assume there's some type of testing that shows that they're competent in mental health and completing this portion of mental health training. They're not just, you know, having this information presented. They do have to get certified as competent in it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that they're getting certain. There will be a series of complex scenarios that will involve a number of threads or themes, and a portion of the total increase from 4 hours to some 20 hours includes those complex threads. Now, there are observers and there are people who will be watching. So if I can just pull a potential scenario out of my head, you know, a domestic violence circumstance involving somebody who has mental health problems. Now, the evaluator will know what the scenario is. And if the officer goes in and they're escalating the situation up, then that's going to be noted and they're going to be counseled and then they're going to hopefully go back through it until they learn to de-escalate and to try to modulate their general demeanor and learn that, you know, well, first off, that there are options that they can hopefully pick from as they go into a real life scenario.
Okay. Representative Nathans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In discussions of us either changing or establishing new performance measures, I hope that it's emphasized that rather than just measuring outputs, number of hours completed in a certain course or getting a certification, I'd like us to keep our eyes on the end result. If the performance was to have better outcomes, such as fewer citizen complaints, better decisions, fewer officer injuries, fewer injuries to people who are, the subject of some sort of a stop or an arrest or something, it seems to me that the performance measurement should be related at that end. Better results for the public and for the officers rather than just in the number of hours kinds of categories.
Sure, and I'm not sure exactly who's chairing, if I should say.
Actually,
Madam Chair, in response.
Oh, I am.
You are now.
All right.
In response to just briefly and kind of anecdotally, you know, the San Diego Police Department did something as a matter of experiment. They, at one point, asked their officers to engage the public more readily, more aggressively, because they were having a problem with officer-involved shootings. They were way high. The direction was then take action as soon as you can and deal with the situation more quickly. What happened is officer-involved shootings went to zero, but internal affairs complaints went inversely the opposite direction. And it became a political problem for San Diego, so they reversed that direction, and subsequently officer-involved shootings went up. So I can't tell you because I'm not a researcher, but I think there is a need to have additional research available to us in terms of public policy and police practices and what should or shouldn't work. But I do know from my own experience as a police officer that if I made a decision sooner and earlier and decided to take somebody into custody, I can often mitigate it evolving into a violent confrontation if I made that decision earlier. That doesn't mean I was walking in being, you know, wider, but rather I recognized that probable cause existed, that the facts and circumstances were sufficient to effect an arrest. I made the arrest and took the person away from the scene. I've likewise seen other officers who walked in and they basically talked themselves into a fight. And what the what happens is people have to learn maturity, and they have to learn how to gauge their comments and interactions with individuals and do it in a mature way. The older I got, the less I liked to fight, the less I liked to get beat up. And so I became very diplomatic, and you started using my brain. And I think you'll see that, because most officer-involved shootings occur between, you know, in the first 5 years, literally, of an officer's career. And I think there's this conundrum in public safety training where you may have the knowledge and you may have the basic skills, but you don't have the maturity yet. And how we implant that maturity is a difficult thing to try to articulate.
But also, John, a lot of the officers in their first 5 years are working those tough shifts in those tough
areas.
Right.
That is true. But Madam Chair, usually working night shift and weekends, and usually districts that no one else wants to work, it does become a little bit more volatile. If I conclude by answering one question that was asked, I believe, and that was a total number of complaints, I believe, Representative Nathanson, you asked that. If you look under the tab on integrity and ethics on the back of, and it may be included in a handout on the back of the flyer, volume number 40, ethics bulletin volume number 40, shows those particular numbers for the cases that were filed.
Yes, thank you for providing that information. I think Representative Hanna has a...
I do. I'm going to change gears on you just a little bit, because I was reviewing your legislation being tracked by DPSST, so I have a question relating to that. In the fire training side of DPSST, do you train volunteer fire department members?
Madam Chair, yes, Representative.
Okay.
Yes, we do.
There's a piece of legislation that I happened to see that I didn't see on here that involved a tax credit for volunteer firefighters,
paramedics,
and others. But it might be of interest to you in that those folks who are paying their own way, in a sense, have an opportunity for a tax credit to obtain that training, both good for the individual and the agencies they volunteer for, and you may want to put it on your bill tracking or measure tracking to be helpful for your folks.
I think that's Representative Boone's office has that.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Hanna, for the record, Eric Gablix. That bill just came out Friday is when we received it, and your packets are already out to you, so we are tracking that. And we've also been working with, as a side note, with the Volunteer Fire Service Task Force, which is trying to look for ways to basically encourage people to be volunteer firefighters in their communities, and training is obviously a big part of that. So we're very supportive, but this is more of an incentive, if you will, to get people some monetary compensation or tax credit, because in some of these communities are actually paying for their own equipment, paying for their own training. This weekend we just hosted a winter fire school at the new academy with some 300 people from across the state. We had people coming up from Brookings, from as far away as Ontario, just to come and get training for a weekend, and most of them were there in their own vehicles trying to get that.
Right.
We have time for up to 5 minutes more of additional questions on this topic, if there are. It looks like we have completed our questions for you.
Sure.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question. Is there volunteer police officers?
Madam Chair, Representative Cameron, the answer is yes, they are. And anticipating the next question is, how are they trained? Somewhat sporadically. There are actually two categories of volunteer police officers in statute. You have a reserve officer, and you have a certified reserve officer. Our agency is by statute authorized to train and certify reserve officers. To date, we have no funding for that particular function, and we've been rebuffed each time we've asked for a coordinator for that particular function. Most sheriff's departments and police departments will choose to use reserves, usually to a limited degree, depending on their competency. And one of the things I can suggest is, I think that the city-county insurance ensures that cities and municipalities throughout the state are as equally concerned about the qualifications of reserve officers because of the potential liability as they are full-time officers. And quite frankly, it is a bit of a conundrum and a problem to get people competently trained. And they are functioning within our communities. So with anything from just a here's your badge and a gun, and a couple of instructions, car keys, go do it, literally, to full-fledged 400-plus hour reserve training programs before a sheriff or a chief will release them to the street, and some ongoing maintenance training that might be there. And of course, these are individuals that are usually working a full-time job or running a business who are also working in this capacity. Usually, they'll work under the direction of a full-time police officer or deputy sheriff in an agency.
Thank you.
Is that it? You have been in front of us for several days. I want to thank you and everyone who's been with you for excellent presentations. It's well organized, informative, and also a thank you for the follow-up materials that you've been providing quickly in answer to everyone's questions.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. It's been a privilege to be in front of your group, and we'll look forward to hopefully a productive work session.
You're welcome. With that, I think my official duty is to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5536, and we are opening. Should I wait for the chair?
I suppose you could.
Mr. Chair, we are ready now to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5507.
Okay. Mr. Prince, should we gavel it?
Yep. You can gavel.
Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5507, Criminal Justice Commission. To tee it up for us before Mr. Prince gets started, Mr. Wilson, would you like to make some comments?
Mr. Chairman, the subcommittee should have a packet, rubber band packet, with the proverbial memo from LFO that I'll quickly go through, then a presentation notebook, as well as the governor's recommended budget binder. Again, as a reminder, please come back and return tomorrow with at least the presentation binder, because I don't think Mr. Prince will make it through his entire presentation. In terms of my memo that's in front of you, I will not go through the mission and responsibilities. It's there for you for your summary, and I'm sure Mr. Prince will cover probably everything that I have in there. The budget notes, emergency board actions, and audit findings are noted there. There were four budget notes. They were related to making sure that the agency continue its up-to-date long-range plans, creating performance measures, which they did, and they will report on in a few minutes or as part of their presentation, and then surrounding the drug courts, and they did return to the drug e-board once during the biennium for the funding for the drug courts, which had been put in a special appropriation. Moving on to expenditure history and revenue sources, there's a table at the bottom of the second page of the memo. You'll see that this agency has a quite varying funding level from one biennium to the next. A lot of that just has to be done with programs moving in and out of the budget. Between 2001-03 and 2003-05 was the transfer of the juvenile crime prevention grants from this agency to the Commission for Children and Families. That was a major funding difference because that had been their primary program, at least in terms of funding. And then the growth from 2005-07 to the governor's recommended budget is basically rolling up the newly created 2005-07 or during the 2005 session of the expansion startup drug court program that was part of the meth package from last session. And just a couple points in terms of policy and budget issues on the last page. I think the executive director, Mr. Prince, will talk about his desire to strengthen the analytical research and policy analysis functions, and there is a policy package included in this budget to do that. The primary reason for the cost or the expenditure increases in the governor's recommended budget is the roll-up of the funding to a full 2 years on the general funded portion of the drug grant or drug court grant program. It had 12 months of funding assumed in the 2005-07 budget. It is rolling up to the entire 24 months in this budget, in the 2007-09 budget. Then there was, after the session, after the legislature went home from the 2005 session, the governor made available and identified burn grant monies, which are federal grant monies, as a funding source for more drug court grants than would have been be able to fund it out of the general fund portion for the current biennium. The governor has also added $3.6 million in this budget for that portion of the drug grant program that doesn't fill a full 24 months of funding for that, just as a warning on that. But the emergency board, when it did provide the general fund portion of the grant funding, did recognize the use of those burn-related grants, but also stated at that time that they assumed that this would be one-time funding and it did not necessarily have to be included in the budget. And then the final issue here is sort of the long-range plan for the drug court program. This is not an operational agency. There are drug court funding in the Judiciary Department, which is, quote-unquote, an operating agency, does operate programs. This is a coordinating agency, a policy review agency. So at some point in time, I don't know if it's this by coming biennium or a future biennium, that should be really taken a close look at it, whether this agency should be continuing to be the primary administrative agency for this program. And, of course, as a side note, the current grants that are out there, when do they become, you know, ongoing funding for drug courses? Do they need to go through another grant cycle? That is another issue that needs to be addressed at some point, either this session or probably next session. So with that, Mr. Chair, those are my comments.
Great, thank you. Before we get started, Mr. Prince, could you just tell us a little bit about your background? I think that's germane to the topic so that people understand.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Prince. I'm the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission. My background is I was a deputy district attorney in Portland for about 5 years, 4 years, and I was the came to the legislature to be the Judiciary Committee counsel in 2001, and enjoyed it so much that I came back for 2003, and then pretty much they couldn't get rid of me after that, and I actually went and was the deputy director at DPSST. Right during the build-up of the new academy, and then was appointed to be the executive director at the Criminal Justice Commission December of 2004, right before the legislative session for 2005. So,
thank you.
And I've got if I can proceed with our presentation, it's a short presentation. There's 41 slides in there. And what I thought I'd do is I've got Devarshi here for the drug court parts. Devarshi's going to be down in Grants Pass at the Josephine County drug court. So I was hoping to kind of tomorrow he's going to be down there. So I was hoping if there's particular questions on drug courts, I was hoping to hit them today, if possible. If not, I'll do my very best to do it myself. So what we've got is an overview of the commission and then a look at our budget drivers.
Before you get going, so that we are sure that people can address those, why don't you try to cut yourself?
Yeah, so let's
slack at the end.
Okay, perfect. We're going to 4:30, is that right? Okay. So,
Chair, just as a reminder, though, keep in mind there's a full day allocated to this agency tomorrow, along with public testimony.
Okay.
Of which I'm not sure if there's going to be very much, from what I understand.
Yeah. So the way we organized it was basically to look at our agency, as Doug said, we're a policy agency. We don't have budget drivers the way other agencies would, where it's driving a caseload. What drives our budgets is basically what we're asked to administer, analyze, focus on, and you'll see that through our little presentation. So we can go over the efficiencies. Our performance measures are brand new. We just got them approved November of 2006. And our budget and POPs, we basically have two POPs. So it's a pretty, I think it's going to be one of the simpler budgets for you to go through. So without further ado, the agency overview, first couple slides. If you look at slide two, our agency's mission is basically to be the forum for long-range planning for criminal justice. And that means that we are supposed to bring the analytical skills and the analysis and also the ability to get to the statistics so that you legislators and the governor's office and the key agency heads can make informed decisions and make an informed policy for criminal justice. It basically requires looking at trends, looking at costs of the system, and then what we've really tried to focus on this last session since through 2005 is to really build the analytical ability to look at the numbers and try to tell you better what they mean. So you can see our agency overview. Slide 3 in our presentation has the commissioners themselves. We've got 7 commissioners. They're very diverse backgrounds. We have 2 non-voting legislative members. Senator Burdick is our Senate member, and Representative Olson is our House member. The historical perspective is, I'm going to do this very briefly. Doug basically said it. We're an agency that gets a responsibility or task. We focus on it, and usually sometimes it stays with us, sometimes it goes away. The guidelines, as you recall, were started in 89. We were basically in 95. We replaced the old council that started criminal justice policy along earlier than that. It was a 24-member council. It was brought down to 7 members, and then we had responsibility for the guidelines themselves. Real quickly, each session will get some, it happens every session, each session will get some new responsibility. And that's great, it's good that we have a focus. The hard part about that is it causes what I call mission creep. It causes us to have to focus on a different disparate thing each session and makes it hard to focus on the long-range planning. But I think that from the presentations that we did with Mr. Oz from Washington, and you saw the economist that we hired, I think we're on the right track with doing that. So basically, the history of the agency goes something like this. In 97, we were given asset forfeiture to oversee. We'll talk about that later. 99, we were given juvenile crime prevention grants. Those were taken out last session. In 2001, we were given racial profiling as an area that we were asked to focus on. In 2003, we got the Senate Bill 267, which we've all, I think, talked about at some, you know, really making sure that we have evidence-based practices and that whole discussion being part of our state system. And we also, in 2003, began the governor's public safety review, which was where the meth task force came from. That was one of our main areas that we focused on for the last 2.5 years. It's been an area that we've been proud to work with. And then last session, we got the drug court grants. Those are the things that really drive our budget. So if you look at slide 6, our budget drivers, basically our program areas, you can basically walk through them. Research and analysis, which is basically focused on sentencing and the guidelines and prison populations. The next area is the meth task force. I want to talk about what we've done with the meth task force. The third area is drug courts. Fourth area is coordinating local public safety councils. Those are the local county officials who do their own public safety planning in each county. We have a coordinating role with them. And then the last two areas, racial profiling and asset forfeiture, are two of the areas that it looks like we might be wrapping up as far as, when I look at some of the legislation in this session and what's going on with asset forfeiture, you can see I'm not putting a lot of putting any resources into asset forfeiture, and I'll explain that. I can't see the clock, so when we hit close, you just stop me and we'll move right to drug courts. Slide 7. I can go through. Okay. So instead of going through the budget drivers in sequence, I would move to slide 17, and I'm going to hand it off to Devarshi. Devarshi is the drug court grant coordinator, so I'll have him introduce himself and walk you through the drug court.
My name is Devarshi Bajpai. Like Craig mentioned, I'm the drug court grant coordinator. Before doing this, I worked at DHS as a methamphetamine policy person, and then before that, I was an alcohol and drug counselor. So, House Bill 2485 directed us to develop a drug court grant program. It was part of the big methamphetamine bill, or one of them. It appropriated $2.5 million for the grant program, and we worked with the people that administer the burn grant with the state police to get an additional $1.5 million for this year and then $1.5 million for next year, a total of $3 million for 2 years. We issued an RFP in January. The program started in July, so it's still a fairly new program in terms of operations. During that RFP period, we received 30 applications from 26 counties and $6.7 million in requests, so we couldn't possibly come close to meeting all the requests that came in to us throughout the state. And that was a couple counties decided not to apply for grants because they weren't sure about the sustainability of the funding. So that was kind of the situation with the grant program. One of the budget notes that we got along with the...
Can I ask you a quick question? What were the counties... let's see. Well, you got 10 counties decided not to apply. You don't have to get it for us now, but if you could get that to the professional staff, we'd appreciate it.
Sure. I can briefly answer some. Clackamas County, I know, decided not to apply for grants based on the concern about sustainability. Other counties just didn't have drug courts in operation or didn't want to start them. So, one of the budget notes that went along with the drug court grant was for the Criminal Justice Commission to work with the Judicial Department to develop performance measures. We did that over the last fall, and the measures are included in your packet. I won't go spend a lot of time on these, but they're pretty generally accepted performance measures that are used nationally as well as by us. These are all tracked by the Judicial Department, and they report on those. The other budget note that we had was to report on the effectiveness and performance of new and existing drug courts. One of the things that I came across was that the U.S. Congress had directed the General Government Accounting Office to do the same thing, and basically they found that drug courts are effective at reducing drug use, they're effective at reducing recidivism, and cost-benefit analyses that have been done on drug courts have shown that they do generate a net benefit despite higher investment costs. Our Oregon data shows the same thing. We show that in Oregon, drug court participants are much more likely to stay in treatment. They stay in treatment substantially longer. The average length of treatment for a drug court participant versus a probation participant was about 4 months longer. That means during that 4 months, they were being closely monitored with UAs. They were going to see a judge every once in a while in some period of time. So close monitoring, not using drugs, not committing crimes, presumably. That's backed up by the fact that 93% of them weren't arrested during the 9 months that they were in a drug court. So.
Can I ask you a question? On page 22, the treatment retention, that indicates that 91% of drug court participants got to 90 days in treatment compared to 79% of just regular probation. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Yep. Thanks. And, lastly, is there statistical significance in the 91 to 79?
We didn't run any statistical significance tests on this, so I'm not sure. Oregon drug courts are among the most thoroughly evaluated in the country. NPC Research, who's presented to the Judiciary Committee back in October, I think, is based in Portland. They're leading researchers in drug courts, and they've done process outcome or cost-benefit evaluations in five Oregon counties. In addition to that, several of those counties, they've done multiple evaluations. For example, they saw that they had good outcomes, and they did a cost-benefit evaluation a couple of years later. So we have the benefit of a lot of research backing up our drug courts in Oregon. Every cost-benefit study that's been done in Oregon has shown a positive net benefit. In Multnomah County, they showed that drug court actually costs less than business as usual, so probation, jail costs, and all those kind of things.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick?
I just wanted to add the information that really surprised me when this study was presented, is that the cost savings, we all expected cost savings at the end of the pipe, but the cost savings were throughout the process, from the very charging all the way through, it saved money, the drug court process.
And in that particular study, thank you, Representative Senator Burdick. In that particular study, they followed participants around with timers. It was a very closely monitored study, so it was pretty accurate, too. In every other study, they've shown fewer arrests, reduced drug use, greater treatment engagement, improvement in living situations. One of the interesting things that they brought up at the Judiciary Committee presentation was that there was one cost-benefit evaluation that showed a positive or a negative effect where it would cost more than it delivered. In that case, when they looked closely at it, none of that drug court didn't follow what are called the 10 key components of drug courts, making sure that the judge knew what was going on, clear communication, all those kind of things. So that is very important that they're monitored. The drug court grants, I realize I'm going pretty quickly through this, and if you want to stop me at any time, please do. The drug court grants, we have 17 grants that went out to counties, 12 of them for adult programs through juvenile, 3 family dependency. One of the things that we found that looking at the research on drug courts was the strongest evidence is in the adult drug courts. There's fewer studies that have been done in the juvenile and family dependency courts, and so that's one area that we really need to develop. With those 17 grants, there's also 11 grants that are burn grants, and in those cases, many of those cases they're leveraged by the grants that we put out because they're general fund, and those are federal grants. So, the vast majority of the grant funds, 91%, go to either treatment or coordinators. That's what was directed by the budget note. That is how it's turned out. The administration, the 4.2% here is not, it's administration at the county level, so it's an important distinction. We don't have any outcomes on this grant program yet. Like I said, it started in July. We do know that in the first 6 months, about 600 people, or 300 people have been served. About 70% of them are medium or high-risk offenders. We know that number of programs have just started up, gotten going. They're building up their participants, so they are operational at this point. So that's my drug court part.
And questions?
No. Thank you. And I just would like to add on to what Senator Burdick said, even, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm sure I speak for when I say, not only is saving money great, but we're hopefully saving these people and getting them turned around, which is hard to afford as well.
And the process of evaluating the drug courts is really important because there's very specific criteria, and the most important criterion is the commitment of the judge. It's a team approach, but that's the one element. The program that we saw in the data that failed, it was where they were spreading it around a bunch of judges. There wasn't anybody really committed in charge. So if you can find that judge who's really committed to the project, that is the most important thing.
And can I ask you a question, too? I assume that some of the grants are also going to complement treatment funds so that you might have, you know, part of the salary of the judge, public defender, district attorney, but some of that is going to pay for treatment as well?
Yes. The treatment money is paying for none of these grants were able to supplant or replace other funds, so they don't pay for any district attorney time, public defender time. The treatment money does pay for things like housing, mental health, employment groups, those kinds of things.
Okay. And I think it's particularly encouraging that you have a treatment background and you can help evaluate the treatment components of the grants as well. Just a couple more minutes, Mr. Prince, if you want
to. I wanted to make one comment that was interesting to me, Mr. Chair, if I could. On slide 22, this is really the only comment I wanted to make, was on the comparison between probation and drug courts, the important thing there is you're comparing probation where there's access to treatment. A lot of probations in some counties, there's a real wait, a long wait for a probationer even to get into treatment. And so the great thing about the drug courts is, as I think the chair's question was going to, you know, we were directed to spend it on treatment, and that's what's occurred. So I think that if you looked at business as usual in a probation county where there's not ready access to treatment, I think the drug courts would outperform them even more. And that's the only comment I wanted to make.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and it sounds like you're doing great work there. We appreciate it. We'll shoot more arrows at Mr. Prince tomorrow. And, thanks.